You see the Lucienne and the movies? I think they can be second. Last night I watched it. I was so excited when I saw Lucienne.
Okay. Morning, everyone, and welcome back to week two. Just to recap a little bit and review so we get the context right for today's discussion. So we've called the series Advanced or Stuck, Challenging Current Thinking About Our Society. As I said last week, based in part on the book called Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier, the new recent book, which has caused some controversy in the world, but it's okay. So we sort of last week was very introductory, so we just talked about different ideas. Number one, we talked about that new discoveries and ideas which are sometimes really good and important, but when they're implemented badly or go to an extreme, that can be damaging. And that's why when there's pushback, it's good, but we have to make sure the pushback doesn't do the same thing and go to the other extreme, creating also damage, right? Talk about clarity. So clarity on issues are hard because sometimes moral clarity is complicated because society, the thinking, the perspectives of modern society, or any society for that matter, can come sometimes from, number one, like a herd mentality. Someone starts an idea and it just sort of spreads and it's contagious and no one actually stops to think if it makes sense or not. Or comes from subjective morality, in other words, what's in the interest of that society at that time, and then they create morals out of that. And we have the pendulum syndrome, where sometimes society fights back on something but goes to the other extreme, as I said before. And that's why we need something called absolute morality, which is something which comes from a higher source, which in Judaism, of course, is the concept of the Torah, Mount Sinai, Revelation, and so on. So we gave an example just in a very general, we're going to talk about something specific today, but a very general example last week from mental health awareness, which has been amazing the last number of decades, which has certainly highlighted, destigmatized, and welcomed new interventions for the various and many, many different types of mental health illnesses and crises and so on. But sometimes there's a problem with over-pathology, where that's becoming a real problem and therefore results in a problem which she refers to as iatrogenesis, which sometimes when you apply something helpful which is meant for someone who's unwell, but you apply it to someone who's healthy, the risks outweigh the benefits and it can actually do damage. So ongoing therapy for healthy people who don't need it can be very damaging, and especially for children. And she highlighted a very important thing, is the proof is that many, many health and medical discoveries and awarenesses have actually helped improve the problem, like penicillins reduced infection and death from infection. Certain cancers have dropped because of the awareness, like breast cancer and things like that, which has been amazing. But actually mental health is not doing so well. Everything's up. Depression, anxiety, everything is actually not being helped so much, and that's a problem. We need to look at that and understand why. And at the end, we just talk about the relevance of all of this is not just a theory, but actually it's a relevant concept, this, because it goes actually to the heart of responsibility. We'll talk about more today, right? So when we have a illness, then it's beyond our control. But us human beings are all born with regular weaknesses, which are not illnesses, they're just normal stuff. And they need to be We need to take responsibility for them because we can. One of the fundamentals of Judaism, of course, is free choice. And we have free choice to deal with these issues, to deal with our personality weaknesses, and so on. Okay, that's just a recap from last week. Now, just a couple of reminders before we launch into today. Just a reminder that next week we're not going to have a session. The rabbis of Sydney have a retreat. We're going away for 2 days for a conference, which is nice. It was very good last year, so hopefully this year will be good too. That's some positive self-care, I suppose, I hope. And then we have this series for another 2 weeks after that, and that'll end the series. And then we have a few different things, and I want to just draw your attention again, and please diarize this because it's going to be really fascinating, I think. On the 29th of August, the week after this series finishes, we're going to have a guest appearance by technology, but from a woman called Dvori Kreiman, the author of Even If I'm Not. She's an amazing person. She went through unimaginable tragedy in her life. I did mention the book in the series of trauma towards the end. But I've made contact with her, and she does a lot of inspirational speaking, and through a very long journey of healing and therapy and all different types of things, she worked through her trauma and her faith, and she's an amazing person and a positive person and worth listening to. So 29th of August, same time, we'll do it as a guest speaker. All right, now, today what I want to do is expand on some of these ideas, but focusing on a specific topic, which I've mentioned in the past, but we're going to sort of unpack it a bit, which in some modern psychological literature today has become, and education systems particularly, has become very, very popular. However, it's become so popular that actually it's become popular in a bit of a damaging way, I think, and it's spread to society in general. Now, I just want to point out, I mean, I'm basing some of it on her book, and some of her book has to do a lot with children. So I'll bring examples from children, but actually, I know that it's not such a relevant example necessarily for everyone, but actually, it's not only about children. Anything that happens in the education system affects adults, and we start acting that way too. So the examples, and maybe the more extreme examples, are from children in education, but the ideas we need to sort of take and apply to our own experience, which is really important. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about the overemphasis on what they call emotional well-being, which of course is important, but and important sometimes, but which we'll talk about. Things like emotional regulation training, what they call now in school social emotional training, emotional check-ins, and all this kind of stuff. And it turns out that the overemphasis on emotions, as much as healthy emotions are very important, and emotional health is important, but the overemphasis on it can actually be damaging, and in various different ways, as we're going to explain. Now, let's just break this down a little bit to clarify. First of all, obviously emotional well-being and emotional health is critically important. We understand that. Part of being a human being, we've talked about this before, our midot, our emotions are actually our personality, and having healthy emotions and what they call today regulated emotions is really important. Also, we also know that if you look from a Jewish perspective, we've said this so many times, the Torah mandates being in touch with our emotions sometimes, mandates expression of emotion or focus on our own pain. For example, in times of grief, we know we have the mandated prescriptive system and process of Shiva and mourning and so on. We have times that we are commanded to be happy. We're supposed to be in touch with feelings of happiness like Chagim, weddings. These are not just things that we celebrate because we like to celebrate, they're actually mitzvot. It's like a mitzvah to go to a wedding and bring joy to the chatan and the kala and so on, right? So of course, healthy emotions are very, very important. EQ is very important. All these things are so important. But the thing is like this, right? That when we talk about starting to focus on emotions, they're normally, in Jewish thinking particularly, we see that they normally are highlighted in specific times. In times where the emotions are heightened and they sort of go beyond the normal. For example, like grief, right? Grief is a challenging time. Any trauma is a challenging time, real trauma. Any challenge, real challenge is a challenging time, right? And these are challenging experiences. And in those experiences, we do experience intense emotions. And sometimes we experience emotions that go out of whack and sort of out of they're all over the place. It could be like a personal problem we're having with someone. It could be a relationship issue. And of course, in such a case, it's very important to be in a balanced way and in a good, healthy way, in touch with our emotions and regulate them. You know, we often quoted the verse that King Solomon says, when you have worry or anxiety, one of the things is just to let it go, but other things is to communicate to others, to share with others, and so on. So that is all true. The problem is this, and this is sort of the foundation of what we're talking about, that routine focus, right? Routine focus on and rumination, they call it, right? Like to ruminate the entire time on the emotions that we have and to sort of identify and highlight and ruminate on the uncomfortable emotions that we have sometimes actually causes, it doesn't cause health. It causes self-centeredness, fragility. You become extra vulnerable and extra fragile and extra sensitive. And that's a problem, because we know what we should be building in ourselves and in our youth and in children and in all of us is what they call today anti-fragility. We should be becoming stronger. We should be fostering resilience. We should be becoming healthy human beings of strength rather than a weakness. So this is a very fine balance, right? Where it's important sometimes to, you know, process emotion and be in touch with it. And then, you know, you say you got to name it, to tame it, all this kind of stuff. It's true, but you got to be careful how much we do it, and when we do it, and how often we do it, because actually it can lead to terrible weakness and fragility, which actually causes unhealthy living, fragility, weakness, victimhood often, and so on and so forth. So let's have a look at all this. So I'm going to start with quoting from her book. We'll go in and out, just talk about different things as they come up. But there's some very interesting parts in the chapter where she talks about this. So she says like this. I'm going to quote just the first part. She says, "The first time anyone suggested that my then 7-year-old daughter had a lot of anxiety, I was not at the pediatrician but at a parent-teacher conference, which she was told the following. The teacher said to the teacher-parent tonight, whatever, she's looking at the clock a lot at the end of the day. The assistant teacher piped up. She seems to have a lot of anxiety about missing the bus. We thought you should know." By the way, this happens all the time now in schools. This is like unbelievable, right? Now, she says, like, it seems unlikely that any teacher a generation ago would have scrutinized a second grader's clock checking at the end of a 9-hour school day, right? I mean, that's kind of normal. Much less have sprung this observation like a magician's reveal at a parent-teacher conference. I knew this was the first year of my daughter was taking the bus without her older brothers, so there was no one to alert the driver if she failed to board on time. But also, her grandfather hates to be late, her father hates to be late, I hate to be late. Worrying over punctuality is very much within our norm of our family. And yet the teacher, who had met my daughter only a few months before, informed me this was grounds for concern, implying that I should get her tested. Right? Now, this is not a one-off thing, by the way. I've heard this all the time, right? They kind of look, and this is a society we're doing this, adults are doing this also. We look for problems, right? We look for problems to identify them as real problems and label them as problems and then get help for problems and go to the therapist for problems and do anything for the problem because it's a pathology. Now, why people are doing this, I'm not sure. I think part of it is lack of responsibility or shifting responsibility, right? But this is the foundation of what I spoke about last week. We all have what's called, we are born with, right? We are born with a godly soul and an animal soul. We are born with a personality. Every person is born with a personality that has weaknesses and strengths. No one's born perfect. We weren't supposed to be born perfect. That is the design of creation, right? On any level. And therefore, we just have normal behaviors that are not a pathology. They're just normal, right? You know, a while ago I quoted the book of Tanya. When the book of Tanya, which is a book that was written as the foundational sort of work of the Chabad Hasidus, as written by Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, he talks about, the book essentially is about the struggle between the godly soul and the animal soul, right? That's what the book is about. And when in the very beginning he introduces each soul and talks about them. When he introduces the animal soul, he talks about the various things that come from the animal soul. He divides it in an interesting way. You know, we say that the world was created with four components, right? The foundation of fire, water, wind, and dust, right? Earth. That's the makeup of the physical world. And he says the soul also has like these four spiritual elements. And each one in the animal soul breeds some not good things. Breeds some good things too, but breeds some not good things. For example, he says, anger and full-blown arrogance comes from the foundation of fire, right? Lust, desire, overindulgent, temptation comes from water, because water, the Kabbalah explains to us, the water is that thing which feeds all the delights and pleasures of this world, right? Lack of seriousness, wildness, making poking fun in a negative way, all that kind of stuff comes from, or just empty arrogance comes from wind, because like just wind is like nothing, so people also, you know, just like are sometimes just empty, right? Emptiness, in other words, right? And then he says laziness and sadness. We're not talking about clinical depression, we're just talking about sadness, being in a bad mood, feeling down, being, you know, not in the mood kind of thing, right? That comes from, which some people have more than others, comes from earth, because earth weighs down. So these are just examples. These are not sicknesses, these are normal behaviors, right? Someone who grows up and is naturally a bit arrogant is not yet a narcissist. Now, there are plenty of narcissists running around, but that's not a narcissist. That's just a person who has a personality flaw that needs to work on it, right? We need to teach these things. These are based on values. We need to educate people to be humble. We need to educate people to be tough, to not get angry, anger management. And everyone has their different balance. You know, some people are more fire, some people are more earth. It's different. Everyone's different because everyone has different strengths and different weaknesses. And therefore, sometimes, as I said last week, it's hard to tell the difference, and that needs a bit of clarification. But if people exhibit behaviors, and children especially, but even adults, right? If we exhibit behaviors that are inappropriate, or toxic, or sometimes difficult or uncomfortable, or emotional that are difficult and uncomfortable, it doesn't mean we're something wrong with us. We're not having a mental health crisis. We're just a normal human being who needs to, once in a while, reflect on our weaknesses and do something about it, and improve. And life is a long journey of improvement. That's what it is. So she continues on, interesting thing. She says, each year, so she said like this, each year the state of California sponsors a three-day public school teachers conference to showcase its vast array of emotional and behavioral services. So I registered. So she went to this thing. So at this thing, she went to this conference of teachers where she wanted to understand what's happening in schools, what's going on, what's the culture. So one of the things that came up, she mentions a whole different thing, I'm not going to go through everything. She mentions that tracking children, so they talked about tracking children in a social and their social and emotional abilities, in addition to academic ones, right? And then the person speaking, one of the people speaking at the conference said the following: our mandate is trauma-informed education. We pledge to treat every kid as if she had experienced some debilitating trauma. That's like unbelievable. Why would you do that? Right? Some of the stuff I'm going to share with you is like so the antithesis of Jewish thinking. It's like amazing, right? We like to treat people as actually if they're healthy, unless something comes up. They're not, right? Yeah. Of course, you have to have awareness and you have to know when to pick up something that's wrong. It's getting a bit hot today, is it? Yeah, sure. Huh? You like it? Okay, we're in a few minutes and we'll take a break from the air conditioning. I don't know, it's hard to balance it. Right? And then one of them said in the conference, forget the Pledge of Allegiance. Today's teachers are more likely to inaugurate the school day with an emotional check-in. Right? And she said, she says, ask kids, how are you feeling today? Are you daisy bright, happy and friendly? Or am I a ladybug? Will I fly away? Or I don't know, something like that, right? And this prompted great excitement in the audience, and teachers jumped to share their own emotion check-ins. One teacher shared a wellness check-in she learned from in teacher training. Every day she asks her kids if they feel it's a bones day or a no bones day. You know what that is? I never heard of that. But anyway, it's interesting. What does that mean? Borrowing the something from some TikTok video in which a pug owner, you know what a pug is? I also didn't know. It's a dog. Right? Apparently, I looked it up. In which, I don't know anything about dogs. I don't like dogs. In which a pug owner shares the mood of his 13-year-old pug, Noodle. If Noodle sits upright, it's a bones day. If he collapses, it's a no bones day. So they ask the kids, it's going to be like a good day or not a good day, basically. In other words, are you having a good day or a bad day? Like right from the beginning, let's find out, like let's kill the day at the beginning. Like let's, in other words, look, everyone who's not having a good day, tell me now at the beginning of the class, I know you're going to like, just, you know, which of course is complete nonsense. And then one teacher said, thank you, it's so fun, love it, thank you. Right, this is where society is going. No one betrayed a worry that having kids peg their day as a no bones at the very start might tend to lock a kid into feeling it was a bad day all day long. Right? Simple logic. Right? Okay. So then she talks about something that she learned from, I don't know, she refers to them as, maybe it's early in the book, I didn't pick up on it, but she learns from two people called Kenner and Linden, who actually were normal thinkers, about who they explained, and they researched this, and they said that actually unceasing attention to feelings was likely to undermine kids' emotional stability, right? This is such an important thing. It's important for us also. We need to, as we're going to develop here, we need to obviously be in touch with our emotions, but not focus on them too much, because it actually has the opposite effect. And they said like this, if we wanted to help kids with emotional regulation, I asked Kenar, she says, what will we communicate instead? I think I'd say worry less, ruminate less, she said. Try to verbalize everything you feel less. Try to self-monitor and be mindful of everything you do less. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's an interesting thing. In Judaism, we have this idea of self-reflection. We're coming up soon to the month of Elul. We always talk about it, right? But actually, from the way the Jewish formula provides it, we see exactly what he's saying. You're not supposed to over-reflect. We have the month of Elul to do that. We have a few minutes every night before we go to bed. You know, we're not supposed to keep on reflecting. We're not supposed to keep on checking in with our emotions, checking in how we're feeling, all that stuff. We have to focus on that much, much less, and we'll see what we're supposed to focus on soon. Right? If you want to, let's say, climb a mountain, right? If you start asking yourself after two steps, how do I feel? You'll stay at the bottom. Right? In other words, it's a really good analogy. When you climb a mountain, you say, I want to get to the top. And that's what I think about. That's it. I don't think about every 5 minutes, how am I doing, how are my legs feeling, is my toe hurting me? Right? You just don't do that. You just get it done. You can reflect later, like how was it? Was it easy? Was it hard? And that kind of thing. Okay. And he says that most psychological studies back this up. An individual is more likely to complete a difficult task if she adopts a task orientation, a focus on the job ahead. If she's thinking about herself, she's less likely to complete it, which is very logical. So let's unpack all of this, right? What really is the focus here is this, and why overemphasis on emotional training and all this kind of stuff is so damaging. Because what we really need to do with ourselves, but also particularly with people when they're very young, part of growing up, right, is we need strength building, which comes through behavior training, right? That's what we do. And that goes into the thing I've quoted for you many, many times, coming from a great early source called the Sefer HaChinuch. We don't even know who the author is, but it's from 12th, 13th century, one of the great ethical sages from in Jewish law and so on. That Acharei HaMasim Nimshach HaLevavot, that the heart follows the behavior. If we, right, we start off, actually this is really important. Of course we've got to be in touch with people's emotions. Of course we should have healthy emotional structure, and when necessary, tap into them and know what we're feeling, if it's painful or toxic or complicated and so on. But actually, our main focus should be doing effective things, because the heart slots in and is affected. The emotions are affected by good and strong behavior. And that's how you build strength, and that's how you build resilience, right? Bearing in mind, again, what we said before, that this starts from a very young age where people have inappropriate behaviors, or kids have difficult weaknesses in their personality sometimes, and it's up to us to train. And the way we train from a very young age, we talk about values when they get older, but actually from a very young age, the way we do it is we model behavior and we teach behavior. Now, it's interesting, I heard a podcast a while ago of some people who are very into this emotional training and social behavior, all this kind of stuff, right? And it's also got, I don't know if you've heard of this, but there's a parenting model. I don't know so much about it. I just know it really doesn't work. But because everyone that talks about it, I don't know, I didn't see the great results. But it's called gentle parenting, right? So this grandmother is talking about, not such an old, like a person who had young grandchildren. She's talking about a story, and she's very into this stuff. So she says, my grandson came over to visit a few weeks ago. And he was jumping on the couch. Now, I don't know what you do if your grandchildren jump on the couch, but I'll tell you what I do in a second. I just had 6 weeks of this. No, it was beautiful. Don't get me wrong. But my grandson came and he was jumping on the couch. Now, I don't want him to jump on the couch. So she says, when I was, and this is the mistake people make with this also, why it's so important to understand the balance of what this means, right? She says, when I was young, I remember, she's a from movement who talks Yiddish, so she was saying, I didn't want to do what my parents would do. My parents would just, and she used an expression, shikem avek, which means like, just send him away. You know, don't jump on my couch, goodbye. And I don't want to do that, right? So I went over to the child and I realized, you know, if a child jumping on the couch, they obviously need to be jumping, right? So she said, I laugh and I say, I think it's so ridiculous, right? I said that, you know, I think that maybe the right thing to do is to take the child gently off the couch and say, you know, I see you want to jump. Let's jump together on the kitchen floor. Now, by the way, it's lovely to jump together with your kids and your grandchildren on the kitchen floor. And people should do that. You should have a lot of fun. You should get on the floor and play ball with them. All true. But this is crazy. I'm sorry. It's crazy. Why? Because it's a normal thing for a child to jump on the couch. And it's also bad behavior. It's not a contradiction. You don't jump on couches. Kids don't understand that. They don't understand when you jump on couches. If it's a new leather couch, you'll ruin it and it'll become messy. And people don't like to have their kids jump, kids or grandkids jump on the couch. So you go over and in a firm way you say, over here in this house, we don't jump on the couch. Very good. End of story. You don't need to give a whole drusha about, I can see you like to jump and you know that. You don't jump on the couch. That's how you teach behavior. You teach behavior. Now, I understand that sometimes we feel that previous generation were too tough because there's a difference between harshness and firmness. It's a very important distinction. Not only between parents and children, between people, right? There's nothing wrong in being assertive about a particular behavior. There is something wrong about being harsh, and harsh doesn't work, right? Yeah, so screaming at a guy, get out of the car, maybe that's not effective, right? Although we all do it once in a while, but that's probably not effective because screaming isn't effective. Harshness is not effective. Criticism for no reason is not effective. But modeling good behavior is very effective. And you do it a few times in this house and assertively with authority, firmly, so the message is clear. In this house, we don't jump on couches. That's what I've been doing for the last 6 weeks. They left today back to America, so. No, just kidding. They're a little bit lebedic, as they say, right? Okay, you make it once. I mean, obviously, you know, we had my daughter and her three kids, lebedica kids, staying with us. So you'd be flexible. You know, so, okay, so we didn't be as tidy as we are normally. That's fine, because the kids living in the house. But there's certain things that are just not happening, right? And there was jumping in the couches. And it made it very clear. We don't jump on the couch. Certain things we don't do, that's fine. I'm not going to psychoanalyze, like, what's behind this behavior and what are your needs? And it's ridiculous stuff, right? All it does is makes people self-centered when you do that. It makes kids self-centered. Can I ask someone just to press that green button? Because it's getting very hot here. Thanks. Perfect. Right. Now, there is sometimes a fine balance. I want to mention something, and this is true with people, and true with children, and true with ourselves, really, right? There's a very big difference between being clear and modeling behavior and teaching strength in a behavior-orientated, task-orientated way, or being dismissive, right? Dismissive is a bad thing. No one wants to be dismissed, even a child, right? So, for example, a child comes back. I'm just giving you a child example so it's clearer, right? Sometimes people do need to be validated, but not validated in like a psychoanalysis journey, right? Just respectfully validated. So if a child comes back and says, you know, my sister was mean to me, right? Now that's for a child, that's an upsetting thing. But it's normal. It's normal stuff. What we don't do is to dismiss it. In other words, say, don't worry about it. That's not true because the child's a bad thing. But at the same time, we don't have to dig deep. So like, you know, nowadays parenting, gentle parenting, they do this. Like a child comes and says, honey's being mean to me. So they'll say, oh, so what are you feeling? How you, come on, understand, that must be very hard. But you know what, just ignore it and finish. Just teach behaviors. Now, again, unless there are children, I mentioned this last week, there are children who are clearly emotionally dysregulated. In other words, because today I talk a lot about emotional regulation and emotional dysregulation. Now, it's good to be emotionally regulated, but not every time a child is upset about something, you have to go through a whole check-in with their emotions in order to regulate them. Because actually, most people are healthy human beings, or can be, and most people, just by modeling good behavior when they're children, and not being dismissive, and just being respectful, and not firm, and not harsh, actually will become emotionally regulated themselves, right? Because there are certain, jumping on a couch, for example, is a very normal behavior, right? When children start to do things that is not normal behavior, that's different, right? I know children, like, for example, they overreact when something like just slightly goes wrong. They just go berserk, not age appropriate. That's different. There are children who need intervention. That's true. But most don't, right? Most don't need to be taught that they have to look at their emotions and how you're feeling, and is it a sad feeling, and is it a think feeling, and there's now diagrams, there's smileys and not smileys, and they're doing this every day at school, spending a half a day, and it's just crazy. And it's not good. It's not healthy. It's not good for people. It's not good for us either. There are adults that do this a lot. That they always are reflecting on themselves and what they're feeling, and I don't feel safe, and I do feel safe, and I feel vulnerable, not vulnerable, and all this stuff. It's not healthy, right? Because unlike that teacher who starts the day like checking in to highlight and to make sure that half the class will say they're not feeling good and therefore ruin the day, right? Actually, we believe that intrinsically things are good, right? And we need to train that, right? You know, I've mentioned this before, there's a Jewish concept where there's a Talmudic law, which the Rambam talks about as well. There's certain cases where a person is, well, I'll tell you where the law is spoken about actually, right? Which don't try this today because we won't be very successful, but we can't do this today. But there is a time, for example, where a marriage breaks down and it's been deemed halachically that the man is actually obligated to give his wife a get, right? There are times in Halacha where, for whatever reason, if it's been a long time, if she can't handle the marriage, whatever the case is, you know, because there is this concept where there's a bit of control in them, well, a bit of control now both ways, but there's the aguna issue and all that kind of stuff. So there are cases where halachically a man has to give his wife a get, but we also know that a man has to give his wife a get willingly. So, what do they do in ancient times, if it's such a case? They do this a little bit in Israel today, in a different way. It says, you beat him up until he says, yeah, I want. Right? Don't try this today, you'll end up in jail. Right? That's a problem, we can't do this today. So, right? But now, so there are, and there's other instances in halacha like that. You can force someone to say, I want to do it, because if he has to do it willingly, which seems like an oxymoron, seems like completely contradictory. I mean, what kind of a want is that, right? So the Rambam says an amazing thing, and I'm quoting it here not for halachic analysis, but for the philosophical idea that comes out of it, right? And that is that a person is multi-layered. We have our conscious desires, and then we have our innermost sort of desires that come from our neshama, and then we have what we, you know, we have our emotional structure, and then we have what we say we're going to do, and then we have what we really want to do, essentially in this case, right? And we believe that if there's something that's morally important and morally obligatory, the deep down desire of every single person is to do it. That is the desire. What's blocking it is the conscious emotional mess up that's covering over the intrinsic desire, that the person says, I don't want to do this. So what you do is you beat that out of the way so that the true self comes out. Now, I'm not saying you should do this to your kids or your grandkids, right? That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that people often ask me, but you know, like I gave you once the example about, you know, gently making a child who's 3 years old or 4 years old share with their 2-year-old sister, right? Which I don't have a problem with at all. I think people should do that sometimes if it's done gently and properly. And but then you're not teaching them. That's not true. Intrinsically, people are born to do good, but they're also born with a big balagan in their structure, and that's supposed to be that way because we're born with an animal soul. We're born to improve. We're born to learn behavior. So all you're doing is you're modeling and teaching and instructing good behavior before you come actually to talk about it. Obviously, when a child grows up and they can understand, you talk about it, you discuss values, you all that kind of stuff, but there's nothing wrong in encouraging task-orientated things when they're young, and it's nothing wrong for us to do the same for ourselves. You know, you've heard me often talk about Sometimes when we think something is right, we don't have to wait till we're quite really there. Like we're quite emotionally ready. We can just do it because it's right to do it. And we'll get there emotionally. We'll get there later, right? So that's the concept, I think, when we talk about that. She says, if we'd adopt a task orientation focus, we get much more results than we will be doing otherwise, right? So just another unbelievable example. She says like this. She talks about a teacher that she heard at this conference. She says, ever since her school adopted social-emotional learning in 2021, Mrs. Julia, I guess it's a made-up name, routinely began the day by directing her Salt Lake City fifth graders to sit on one of the plastic chairs she'd arranged in a circle. And this is how they started the day, fifth grade. How is each of you feeling this morning, she would ask, performing a more intensive version of the emotional check-in. One day, she cut to the chase. What is something that is making you really sad right now? That's a great way to start a day. Unbelievable. And then the whole thing happened when one boy had to turn to speak, started mumbling about something that was happening at home, and it just created a whole mess in the class. Now, one should be, a principal, a teacher should be aware if something's wrong with the child, they're exhibiting different behaviors. On the side, you find out what's wrong. And, you know, it could be a tragedy at home, it could be turmoil, it could be a marriage problem at home. All this stuff could be happening. But you don't make that the focus of the class at the beginning of the day to mess everyone's day up. That's not the way it's supposed to work, right? Now again, going back to the Jewish view, of course, we know, we've said this many times, we have a completely opposite version of this, right? How do we start our day? Well, how should we start our day? We're grateful, gratitude, and moderni. And you've heard me say before, you know, in fact, the Zohar says, Kabbalistically, the Zohar says that the first thought and the first verbalization that we have during the day affects the entire day, right? So it says when a person wakes up, they should be thinking about, so it's a gift, it's a God-given day, we're before God, we're going to make this day personal, and then we say, Moderni. Moderni is an unbelievable proclamation. We start off the day, we force ourselves, even if we went to bed in a really bad mood, we force ourselves at the beginning of the day to start the day with gratitude, because we always have what to be grateful for, including and mainly for the new day we've just received. And then we say the last sentence, as we've often talked about, we say, Rabba emunatecha, great is your faithfulness, meaning how God believes in us. Now that's the way to start a day. You start a day with getting up in the morning and say, God believes in me, he's given me a day, I'm grateful for the new day, I'm going to try and make this day work because he believes I can, otherwise he wouldn't have given me this new day. That's a whole different perspective, right? To start with positivity, because positivity is, we have it innately. We all have an innate resilience. We all have an innate goodness. We all have an essential positivity. And that's what we need to try and bring out. That's what we need to focus on. And the way we focus on that is getting on with the job, climbing the mountain. You wake up in the morning, going back to that analogy, that you wake up in the morning, I've got a mountain to climb, and I know I'm going to do it. God believes I can do it. I need to believe myself that I can do it, and let's get on with it. Now, there are times we need to stop. There are times that, in a controlled way, we might have stuff to deal with, but we don't deal with it as a foundation of our existence. I think this is the crux of it, right? I've often quoted, again, a different part of Tanya, where he says that guilt has a place, for example, right? Guilt has a place, positive guilt, has a place in the way of being an uncomfortable situation where it motivates you to do better. But you don't start the day with guilt. You designate times, control times, certain times where you deal with unfinished stuff. So when we get up in the morning, our first thing is let go of any stuff. We let go of yesterday. We let go of the baggage. But we'd have stuff to deal with. Okay, so we'll designate a half an hour sometime during the day to sit down. Complicated. I insulted someone yesterday. I'm feeling bad about it. All that kind of stuff. What am I going to do about it? We make a plan. And as I say in Yiddish, weiter gegangen. Like we move forward. Right? That's very, very different. So what I want to do is I want to quote two things from a different book about a whole different, about a quite a radically different perspective. It's a book I bought now in New York. It's called Letters for Life. It's written very well. I might do a whole series on it, actually. It's a very beautiful book. It's someone who's written a book on different themes of emotional well-being, based on stories, anecdotes, and letters from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe wrote a lot about this stuff, and this is one section. I'm just quoting some stuff from it. Interesting. Two things that I want to bring out. The first thing is this idea of focusing and not being so self-absorbed in what we're feeling and what we're going through, and so on and so forth. is very much highlighted in many answers and things and stories with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where his solution, or one of his solutions, was that if we are challenged by this, if we are finding it difficult, what we need to do is start focusing on others, right? Because if we start focusing on others, we actually focus less on ourselves. Again, highlighting the same idea that over-focus on self doesn't breed anything positive. Over-focus. Of course, we have to take care of ourselves and all that kind of stuff. But over-focus on self locks us in ourselves and prevents us from growing, prevents us from doing for others, and prevents us from achieving a higher purpose, because we're always so locked in our own prison, in our own borders, in our own mitzrayim, as we've said so many times. So in one letter, the Baba Chava writes to a person who obviously had complained about feeling anxious or feeling, you know. Again, and we're not talking about when it's clinical and when it needs real intervention and all that stuff. Just talking about the regular stuff that we go through, right? So he writes to him quite sharply and he says, "You are much too wrapped up with yourself." He wrote to a young man who wrote about his dark ruminations. "You must get away from yourself and begin to think of others. It is time to begin an active participation in society, to give and give generously. The opportunities are many and the need is great." Right? Then he brings a story. There was a man, and I remember him, his name was Reb Beryl Yunick. He lived in Crown Heights. He was Russian, and when he was 20 years old, in 1950, he came to New York. They managed to leave Russia. He came and he wanted to connect with the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. Unfortunately, 10 days after this chassid arrived in New York, the previous Rebbe passed away. And then his son-in-law, who I always referred to as Lubavitcher Rebbe, my mentor, was for a year sort of resisted taking on the leadership of the Chabad movement. Eventually, he knocked on his door and he said, I need to speak to you. He said, he forced himself in. He said, "I know you're not taking people, but I want to have what's called the Yechidus, which is when you like ask the Rebbe various different things and guidance and so on." So then later they found in his notes that he'd written some notes and diaries of stuff. So he wrote the following. He said, "I relayed to the Rebbe that I have good periods. Other times I find myself feeling down or over my spiritual state of being." And he responded and he responded different things. And one of the things the Rebbe responded, he says, "This is a problem of many of our young people. They analyze themselves too much." This is 1950, it's interesting. Right? "It is necessary to think about others for at least an hour a day." "When a thought about your state enters your mind and you see that it is disturbing you from what you should be doing, increases a feeling of depression or dejection, you should push that thought away. If you have not a way to dispel the depressing thought because you're not in a good state, and so you have reason to be dejected, you should remind yourself of the obligation to help others. Think about others and how you can make things better for them." That was his advice, right? And then he brings a beautiful story, and I tell you why I love the story, because it involves a woman called Mrs. Tybel Lipska. Now, it's related, yeah. So I knew Mrs. Tybel Lipska. I knew in an interesting way. That's why it was very beautiful for me to read the story. I'll just give you the context. When I first got married, we lived in Brooklyn in Crown Heights, and I was studying in Kollel then. And someone asked me to give a once-a-week shiur in Yiddish, which I speak Yiddish, to a group of elder women who would gather in 770 once a week. And I don't know, someone that was doing it, but then moved away, so they were looking for someone else. And I was asked to do it, which turned out to be a really good thing, because Dina's grandmother was part of the group, and she loved it, and was, you know, that kind of thing. So, and there was a group of women there, and one of them was this Mrs. Tybel Lipska. She was quite elderly at the time when I knew her. But very sharp and very bright. I'm not sure, I don't think she had the opportunity to have a formal education in Russia, but they knew, there was a group of them, they knew an amazing amount. And I was this young guy, and she was quite a sharp lady, I remember. I was this young guy, just married, and I was giving them a shir. And part of the shir is, you know, the Rebbe used to have these talks on Shabbos, so I'd spend the first 10, 15 minutes of the shir reviewing some of the things the Rebbe had spoken about on Shabbos. And I remember once I was quoting from a Mishnah and that the Rebbe had explained, and the Mishnah is authored by one of the great Talmudic sages called Rab Elazar ben Azaria. His name was Elazar. Now, in the Mishnah, there are two rabbis. One's Rabbi Elazar and the other one is Rabbi Eliezer. They're very similar sounding names. And I got confused, and as I was quoting the Mishnah, I said, "This is a Mishnah written, it was authored by Rabbi Eliezer." And as I said that, Mrs. Lipska came booming back, Rabbi Lazar ben Azar. I'll never forget that. I said, you're right. Anyway, but this is a story when she was young, a very interesting story, relating to two people. But listen to just this come out in a very nice, beautiful way. So she came from Russia. She came from a very tough background. You know, the persecution in Russia, the communism, was really, really terrible. There's many, many stories about that. And they escaped Russia. They spent some time in displaced camps, displaced persons camps, DP camps, and eventually they came to the United States. It wasn't easy. Her parents tried to one job, another job, didn't work. Eventually they moved to Brooklyn. So she had a lot of upheavals, and she felt herself sort of being anxious and sometimes down. And she decided to consult the Rebbe for guidance. So the Rebbe gave her very unexpected advice. The Rebbe said to her, go to as many weddings as possible and dance and inspire other people to dance as well. So he told her to do. Now apparently she knew how to dance very well. And it's not like here in Crown Heights, weddings are like you, anyone can drop into a wedding. I mean, you wouldn't unless you knew the person or you invited. But she took this advice very seriously. She was a very skilled dancer. She would go, and there were a lot of women at that time. This was in the 50s, 60s. There were many women getting married who didn't have a lot of family. Some of them from Holocaust survivor backgrounds, and so she would go and she would make a levity. She would just dance the night away, like with these. She'd pull people in. Anyway, okay, that's the story. Now, there was another woman, a younger, much younger woman in Crown Heights. I don't know who she is. I've spoken to her. She's an editor of one of the Lubavitch magazines, whatever. Her name is Rishi Deitch, and she was a young girl of 14. When she moved out of her parents' home in Massachusetts to go study in Brooklyn in high school. They didn't have a high school there, a Jewish high school. They sent her to Brooklyn. And she says New York was very different. It was like hard energy, and it was just very, very fast moving and very difficult for her. And she was not doing well. One night she says, I was at a wedding. I didn't know the dances that everyone was doing, and the noise was unbelievable, and it was all new to me. I couldn't keep up, so I just stood on the side, and I didn't try. Right? Suddenly, this older woman, this whirlwind dancer, grabbed my two hands with her two hands, pulled me into the center of the circle. I tried to pull away and explain, I'm from Worcester, I don't dance. But she couldn't hear me anyway, and the noise was too big. So she had me with an iron grip, so I took my only option, other to faint, and I danced. She said, it would not be an exaggeration to say that I had more fun in that one dance than I had my entire life up to that point. She whirled me around, she flipped me this way and that way, I just followed her lead, since I was absolutely zero choice in the matter. After it was over, she asked my name. I was too shy to ask her name, but later someone told me that was Mrs. Tybalt Lipska. Right? I always remembered the dance, but I didn't know there was something deeper to it. It was only many years later that I heard the story that she went through and that the Rebbe's guidance to her that she has to go to weddings and dance. Right? So the point is very clear. The point is we need to be a little bit less wrapped up in ourselves, in touch with ourselves, healthy, make sure we're healthy emotionally and all that kind of stuff, but a little rest left on ourselves and more making room for other people. And that breeds a lot more kindness, it breeds a lot more health, and it breeds more productivity and effectiveness and positivity. The last point is, just from the same book, is one of the things that an over-focus of on our own emotions and how we're feeling, and especially doing this with the kids, what it leads to is that we tend to hang on to a lot of stuff, right? We tend to hang on to stuff because we take it too seriously. Now, there are serious things in life that we have to work through, but some of the time what we really need to do is just let go. And let go is part of emunah, it's part of bitachon that we've talked about many times. And the book quotes a very beautiful analogy, a parable, which I want to share with you. I've heard it before, but it's very beautiful. And it comes from the Magid of Dubna. There was called a Dubna Magid. And he said like this, a poor man was once trudging along the road, carrying a heavy burden on his shoulders. An expensive-looking carriage, drawn by two mighty horses, was passing him by, and it came to a sudden halt, and the owner jumped out of the carriage and said, you're walking yourself, come, why don't you come onto my carriage, and I'll give you a lift. So he accepted, gladly accepted. The carriage was continuing along the road when the wealthy man noticed that the passenger was still holding the bag. My good man, what in the world are you doing? Why don't you put your sack on the floor? So the humble traveler replied, dear sir, you have been kind enough to me already. Your carriage has to bear the weight of my body. How can I burden you with a bundle as well? Right? So the host laughed and chided and says, don't you see that it's the same for me if I hold your load on your shoulder or put it down, I'm carrying it anyway. And the Dubna Magid said the following. He said, Putting down our load and allowing God to carry it for us can be hard. Like the poor man in the story, we each have a burden we used to carry, and we can't always fathom letting it go. It takes reflection and practice that God is carrying it anyways. Why don't we just put it down? Okay. And this is the concept. And it brings it to the book because one of the pieces of advice, there's a phrase that the Lubavitcher Rebbe would use very often in letters, when appropriate, of course. And he would use this phrase of Hesech Hadas. Hesech Hadas is when you have these intrusive thoughts, or you have this agonizing thoughts, or you're feeling the weight of something, and it's something you don't need to hang on to. He'd always say, you need to get rid of that thought. And the way he advises to do it often is to replace it from a different thought. Because it's very hard to get rid of a thought. We have these ideas that come into our head, and sometimes we can't get rid of them. Why? Like we'll carry, like I've told you many times about Twisky, is to say, when we have a little bit of an argument with someone, we let the person hang out in our mind rent-free for a few weeks, a few months sometimes, right? We need to get rid of that. And the only way to get rid of that is to completely distract ourselves away from the thought. Now, thoughts are very difficult to let go of. So sometimes the only way is to have things that we think about, that we use and we call upon when we have those thoughts. And we want to make them unwelcome. We have positive things we think about. It could be a shiur, it could be a nice story, it could be a plan that you want to make, it could be something you need to think about, something positive. Or it could be, as he said in many, many times, to just start thinking about other people. What can I do? How can I help? Where can I volunteer? What can I help someone with physically, spiritually, emotionally, whatever the case is? How can I be of assistance to other people? The main point really is to get rid of that load, put it down. Let God run the world. Not everything we worry about is worth worrying about. There's so much that we worry about that we can't control anyway, right? Of course, worrying is a good thing. God gave us the idea of worry because sometimes we need to worry to create a sense of urgency to do things that are in our control. But there's most of the time we worry about things that are not in our control. Let God carry the worry. There's a pasuk, a verse, where King David actually says this in the Psalms. He says, Hashleich el Hashem yehavcho. Throw your burden to God. Like, let him worry about it, right? So, but we can only do that if we focus less on ourselves. So I guess the point of what we're saying is that to be emotionally healthy is a very good thing. But the problem that's becoming is, and being in touch with emotions and processing toxic emotions, all that is good. When things are really out of hand, of course we need to focus it on. When things are completely out of hand, we need intervention. That's all true. But the idea of normal stuff starting to bother us and the idea of hanging on to that stuff and increasing the hanging onto it by inducing a problem when it doesn't even have to be there, by making sure that you check in and you know how you're feeling and you do the emotional check-ins to children or to yourself every single day and focusing on myself and how I'm feeling and am I strong, am I weak and all this kind of stuff, it doesn't breed anything good. We need to be action-focused, we need to be positive, we need to start the day in a positive way, and when we focus less on ourselves, we get more done, we let God carry the burden, and we continue and we move forward in trying to reach the golden destination where we're going to. Okay, just a reminder, next week we're not on, and 2 weeks' time we'll continue the series for another 2 weeks.